You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. And Tracy, it's Saturday. It is a Pathfinder day for me. That means I will have a house full of people later. My dog is very excited about that, obviously. But I think the thing that has made it for me was that was one of the best guest reactions to Grogu headbanging that we've had in a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Amal is here for it.
Yeah.
I mean, Amal is here to talk to us about books and stuff, but also here for Grogu. Amal Amatar, how the hell are you?
I am all the better for A, seeing your beautiful faces, and also Grogu headbanging. It was very unexpected. Here I was thinking I was like being slightly, you know, goofy by bopping along to the music, and I could see myself on this camera. But then, you know, to be upstaged and like outdone moves wise by
Grogu.
He just
wants to be involved.
And a bobblehead Grogu.
That is a beautiful object. Do you remember when The Mandalorian first came out, how somehow like Disney had not yet prepared merch for Grogu? And there was this dearth, this like period of time where everyone wanted some kind of tangible physical representation of Grogu. And I did not do this, but I appreciate it. Everyone else who just made their own. And just, you had this proliferation of crocheted Grogu's and various other things. And anyway, I think that's a delightful object.
It kind of reminded me of two things. Number one, it's not the first time that's happened. Because when Star Wars hit big, there was no merch. In 77, merch. Yeah,
really?
because George Lucas went to every single toy manufacturer and they all turned him down except for Kenner. Mm-hmm. And Kenner said yes, but they did not have anything for Christmas that year. They didn't have stuff until the Christmas of the year. So what they did was they sold a picture of all the figures, and it said, you know, it was like a coupon or something. Mm-hmm. Like it was just a stand up cardboard picture thing, and then you bought all your stuff. And then also Yoda. I remember when Empire Strikes Back came out, my aunt hand painted me a Yoda shirt because they didn't have a Yoda shirt yet.
Incredible.
Yeah.
They always bet against the short guys, huh?
They do, yeah.
Never let
actually things. Another way to say that would be against the short guys always they bet.
Wow, that is another way of saying that.
It sure is.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole like linguistic puzzle surrounding Yoda, really, isn't there? And I feel like you're an excellent person to meditate on that with, Amal, because like it's very much a space you kind of live in naturally. But if I recall correctly,
talk like this, I will listen. You shall.
Oh my god!
Right. And so like if I remember correctly, in the moderately cursed prequels, we have like Yaddle, who is also of the same unnamed species as Yoda, but doesn't have his speaking pattern. So like there have been all sorts of fan theories that have emerged. Like Yoda is like the hillbilly version of like whatever that alien type is from their planet, or is this that what a posh accent looks like? Or is he, does he have like a speech impediment or?
Deep in the holler come I from.
I mean, it's funny to think of like this needing a lot of fan theory, just because one of my favorite moments in just nerd culture properties, I don't even know what, and was, you know, when they rebooted Doctor Who and Christopher Eccleston meets Rose. And she's like, if you're an alien, why do you sound like you're from the north? And he says, lots of planets have a north.
Yep.
And it was just like, yes, actually, in fact, you know, this sort of like shorthand in SF of everyone from a planet looks and sounds the same is nuts. Like that is ridiculous.
Yeah. The whole planet of hats thing.
Yeah, lots of planets have a north. It just is great. And it was specifically lots of planets have a north, like as opposed to lots of countries on planets have a north. But nevertheless.
It was a great moment. Yeah.
For sure. Oh my gosh. So, I mean, it is sort of impossible for me to capture how charmed and delighted I am to have you on, because it's been forever. It really has. And the river is just such a delight. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about here, Amal is with us for many reasons, her charm not least amongst them. but in March, her latest book, The River Has Roots, came out. And it is...
The book that came out in March is Seasons of Glass and Iron.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Now, Seasons of Glass and Iron, March, River Has Roots.
Last year.
Oh, my gosh. Whole year back.
River Has Roots came out last year. However, it is currently in the... It's been nominated for a bunch of...
We're back in the conversation there.
The paperback came out this year.
I'm puzzled. So I have been corrected in real time, and this is great.
We say paperback now, which size are we talking about? Are we talking about trade paperback?
Like trade paperback. One?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
mass okay. market, book, I think. Farewell.
The book is small as a hardcover anyway, due to it being a novella. The paperback is the same dimension.
Sure. Yeah. Because I think I like shared with our patrons not long ago that like they're getting rid of the traditional quote unquote paperback size. Like,
yeah. Not doing the mass market. Anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is which is in and of itself like a whole kind of sea change for I don't know, even just what people's shelves look like. Certainly what used bookstores will come to look like in about 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Thinking about both Seasons of Glass and Iron, which is, of course, an anthology, and it must feel very cool, by the way, to have an anthology where you're like, this is all just me. Like,
yes,
I'm not contributing to like a theme thing, like literally me. Like, I've done a lot of stuff. I'm very tired.
It's like 15 years worth of short stories, and it is very fun. And I mean, say 15 years worth, I'm not that prolific, so it's like there are 18 things in the book, but they were all in different anthologies and magazines and on the internet or in print in various places, so to be able to actually gather them together into one book was really delightful, and it's really nice to have that and to be like, these are the stories that I am proudest of from the last 15 years of writing and stuff.
So, because I had River Has Roots on my mind, I haven't looked at the table of contents for Seasons of Glass and Iron recently. Is Pockets in there? Make it?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, used Pockets in my classroom a couple weeks ago, and I heard the most heartwarming conversation between two young men in the back of the classroom setting themselves up like before things actually got underway. And they were doing the whole, what did you think of the reading for today thing?
Aww.
Which sometimes when they do that conversation, it's because one of them didn't do the reading and the other one wants like a speed run of it in case there's a quiz of some kind. But sometimes it's just like literally, what did you think? And this was that type. And student A says to student B, says like, I thought it was a perfect story for me because it's the sort of story that embodies what I think of when I think of a story that has fantastical things happening in the real world, that they happen and we don't know why and we just have to sort of lean into them. And I felt like that was very true to my experience. There's a pause. Aww. Kid B is like, bro, does shit just turn up in your pockets? And then like class had to start, but I was like, I'm going to pocket, pun intended, this memory for when I talk to Amal in a couple of weeks, because
oh
damn.
Oh my gosh, that's beautiful. What did he say? Does stuff just turn up in his pockets?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But he apparently felt quite strongly that it was, actually, he's writing a paper on it right now. So,
oh, that's so lovely. Thank you so much for telling me that. That's amazing. That's really delightful.
It is. I guess that's sort of like a major takeaway that I have from so much of your work, that there is, even when stories have pain in them, even when there are frustrations and tragedies, you know, inside the stories and inside the characters' experiences, there's also just a tremendous amount of love. And a tremendous amount of thoughtfulness about people. And I think that one of the ways that shows up that I think is super interesting, and this is a River Has Roots type question here, is, as I was reading from The River Has Roots, I was so struck by the narrative voice. Mm. And I think there's a couple different ways that books that have a sense of, like, this is not just like an omniscient third or a limited third person sort of thing, but like there's a definite sense of a storyteller who we don't know as a person, but who speaks to us in the kind of cadence of a person and with the habits of a person. They're kind of self-correcting. They're rhetorical. They're talking to the you who is the reader in a very direct way. And I am so curious as to what brought you to that voice.
I'm so happy you're asking this. I mean, what brought me to it is realizing that I love that voice, and there has been a dearth of it. It used to be, it used to make up a lot more of my reading, and it made up a lot more of my foundational reading. And it has sort of fallen out of fashion. In there is a lot of, and I mean, I say that my favorite point of view, which obviously is a normal thing for a person to have, is second person. And I, you know, second person, present tense, I love that kind of direct address. I love the intensity and intimacy that it sort of forces you into as a reader. I love the questions that it provokes in terms of who actually is talking to whom. Like, am I the reader being addressed, or is it someone in the story? Is this a character in the story, or is this a different kind of device? It just activates me. Like, I really get into it. But that said, you know, it is also very intense. And sometimes I just want to be told a story. And I want to have that fairy tale feeling of a once upon a time voice, you know. And so many fairy tales end with, even if they don't open with this device, will end with, and they were wed, and I danced at their wedding, you know, and I can tell you, right? So it ends with this kind of sense that you have been told a story by a person who wasn't in the story, but who knows and witnessed the events in some way.
It's like assertion of credibility.
Yeah, there's an assertion of credibility. There is an assertion that all of the fantastical things that you just experienced were real, in fact, right? Like that all of all of the glass slippers, all of the dragons and other things, they are real. We are still in that world. Like there is a bridging of the story has ended, but the world of the story is now part of you and is also something that persists. But all of that aside, so this is a very long way of saying that I love the fairy tale affect that of narration that tells you a story. It felt appropriate to retelling a ballad, but I also was very self-consciously wanting to invoke Hope Merle's and Lud in the Mist, which is a book I really love, and that has that kind of narration. It has a sort of It has a narrator who is kind of knowing and who is a little arch and who is going to tell you a story under the skin of which you can hear opinions, but without being, you know, actually a present character participating in the action. And I think specifically, too, because I wanted language and grammar to be so much a part of the story and so much a part of the way the story functions, that having a narration that could be sly and flexible and shift from drawing your attention to something the way that a friend would, saying, you know, come look at this thing over here. Or, you know, talk about the story as something that has happened, but is also currently happening, you know, like that kind of temporal flexibility as well. All of that felt like the province of this specific type of narration.
That is So this is a complete, this is not a question I expected to answer, but especially you bringing up the grammar. Have you ever read Charles Yu's How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe?
I haven't. I'm aware of it, but I haven't.
Yeah, the whole idea of, so in case this is something you don't already know, Patrick, so the book, which is not very long and totally worth it and very funny and sort of like, very funny and also hopeful and sort of sad and kind of emotionally complex, but not in a kind of like draining, exhausting kind of way. There's a time travel repairman character, and he is repairing people's time machines, which are basically like, you know, like tiny little smart cars that go through space time. And the way that they're powered is they're powered by grammatical logic. And so like, you don't like, I don't know, figure out the coordinates in space-time you want to go to. You like figure out grammatically how to frame where you are going in space-time. Like, I want to go to like the past perfect theoretical. And there are like little graphs inside the book in places where he's like sentence diagramming his way to like, how do I get to this next place? And it's just, even if like grammar is not your thing, which... Fair bet. That's for most people, not really so much. It's just like deeply cool as this interesting way of taking a trope and playing with it completely differently.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So thinking about Seasons of Glass and Iron, you know, as an anthology, in a way, in anthologizing your own work and drawing together these different stories from a 15-year span of your work, you're almost becoming a narrator of yourself. Or like a narrator of your, because you choose, what are you putting in there? What order am I putting it in? Am I prefacing these things in any way? Do I see these stories as having a relationship to one another that I want to emphasize somehow? Do I just want them to stand on their own? And so how did that curative process work for you?
Very much as you describe, in that I did feel that I needed to say something about the project of the collection without falling into what I see as a trap a little bit of wanting to talk about every single story. And I think I say in the preface something like, you know, resisting the urge to treat it like a photo album and say, right, I was, you know, living in Cornwall when I wrote this, and it was about these things, and these are, you know, I feel like that I'm so of two minds about that sort of thing, because on the one hand, as, you know, a curious person, if I encounter those sorts of like little italicized paragraph blurbs preceding a story in an anthology, whether they're by the editor of the anthology or by the author, they are additional texts, and I love text. And so I, you know, am interested in those texts, but I'm less interested in what they're telling me about the story than I am in the things that they are not deliberately telling me, you know, like what is the, what is going unsaid? Why were these things, you know, like there's a kind of like scrutiny or investigation. I guess it's just like an academic hang up thing of, I look at it and I'm like, ooh, you've given me more text to consider. And so now I will, you know, bring the same scrutiny to this text. I'm not just going to trust what you're telling me. That would be ridiculous. You know?
Why would I do that?
Why would I do that? But that that being said, I also think that as much as there is a kind of scrutinizing pleasure to be had, I also think there is a danger of overdetermining the space, or, you know, telling a reader how to encounter a story or, you know, what to take from it in some way. So I didn't want to be doing that. I wanted to reflect on the collection as a whole. The process of choosing the stories and the process of figuring out what the project was it took a little time, because initially I had thought that I would write new stories for it. This is part of a 4-book deal that I have with Tor. The River Has Roots was the first of them. Short story collection is the second. And I'd had some notion that when I finally collected stories of mine, there would be new stories written specifically for the collection that would, you know, tie things together or anchor things. You know, there's one of the ways in which people talk about short story collections is the idea of like one longer anchor story or whatever that sort of brings everything together into a kind of cohesive narrative logic or whatever. And I did think I was going to do that. There was a version in my head where The River Has Roots was that story before, you know, it became its own thing. But then when it became clear that due to the constraints of temporality, I would not, in fact, be able to write new material for it, I began to feel this this sort of wrestling with the question of whether or not to apologize for that. To be like, I had intended to write new things. Now it's not going to be new things. It's going to be collecting older things. Do I have to? Why should I apologize? I don't have to apologize for that. Why do I feel the need to apologize for that? You know, of this kind of came together as something I started to think about. And I definitely felt that I wanted to first, like, look at the material and see what I was choosing, figuring out that, okay, now that I'm not going to have anything new to the collection, what story do my stories tell to me if I put them together and read a whole bunch of them at once? And the story that it told me was, wow, I really like to write women talking to each other.
Nothing wrong with that.
Agreed. And then I was like, well, I mean, that's certainly something I'm not going to apologize for. So I think that once I saw, you know, a thread through the stories that was that, and that was a kind of the sort of gentleness of the mirror I was holding up to the, you know, last 15 years. And it helped me feel like there is something here worth putting between boards and saying, this is a collection. You know, this is a collection that does stand on its own, does have its own like cohesive logic, is also a statement about what has been most important to me for the span of time. And that I'm just kind of, you know, offering it up to there's also a degree of you know, as part of the curation, of feeling really vulnerable and being like, wow, I was, you know, barely in my 20s when I wrote some of these things, and and to just kind of realize that there is, you know, you don't, when you're writing one story and it appears in a magazine, you don't necessarily feel like you're putting your soul on display. It's a glimpse. It's like a tiny part of you, right? But you put enough tiny glimpses and parts of you in one document, in one book, and suddenly you can start to feel really naked and just really exposed. And it's like, and that's a, I think, different process to the writing of a single book, right? Like, you know, the engaging with a specific story or idea, you can really, you know, drape yourself in the proverbial cloth of story. You know, there's the whole parable about like truth being naked and people can't look at truth. And so she, you know, puts on the clothing of story, and then people can look at her and so on. But you know, enough of that accumulated together, and the parts that peek through the cloth are a lot more available and numerous and stuff. So there's just a lot more vulnerability, really. Yeah. And as a consequence, the reception that I've been fortunate enough to see people have, the reception I've been fortunate enough to see of the book, in as much as, you know, sometimes when people tag me on Instagram, or, you know, the nice reviews that are carefully curated and forwarded to me or something, have been especially moving, because mm-hmm. I feel like it's not people being nice to me now. It's people being nice to a much younger version of me who was sure. often yeah. really lonely and sad and stuff. So,
yeah, I was going to say a moment ago that it sounds a little bit as if part of the process was being indulgent and kind towards past you. Mm-hmm. And that what you're hearing in some of those responses is people who are finding themselves happy to do the same without, yeah,
Yeah, it's funny. There's actually a little nuance there, which is that I was expecting on some level the same indulgence that I'm bringing to those stories. And that hasn't actually been what I've seen. Mm. Excuse me. What I've seen is people just encountering the stories as work that is new because it's new to them. And right. so where I have this perspective on these stories of some of them feel like juvenilia, some of them are older work, some of them are stories in which I see seeds of things that I later developed, you know, more fulsomely or differently from a different place. That's not what people who have read Time War or The River Has Roots are seeing in them. They're just seeing more work from a person whose work they already enjoy, and finding something in it that is actually current to them, or like, mm-hmm. you know, an insight that is contemporary or present, like that in fact, it's not indulgence yeah. that some people are meeting it with, but just pleasure. Yeah. And that has been really surprising. It's like it's surprising in the sense that it made me aware of what I had been expecting, which was that kind of, you know, hopefully indulgence, and instead to realize that, you know, the contexts in which those stories were written were contexts of communities and readerships that are contained within, like, how can I put this? So they're like a smaller circle, essentially, mm-hmm. and that the stories being read by people outside of those circles means that they're always going to feel new to someone, essentially.
Yeah.
It's that on some level I had been thinking, I think, that, oh, someone is going to pick up this book and be disappointed that there's a story in it that they've already read, you know, which is silly. I mean, that's not how I experience anything, you know, like mm-hmm. if I buy an album that has a song on it that I've already heard, I'm not like, oh, this is a waste of my money. It should have all been new. And yet, nevertheless, that was kind of a big fear that I had.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because when you were talking about choosing the stories and mm-hmm. putting this anthology together, there's a couple of different thoughts. It's like, you know, finding stories that have some sort of common theme or a thread that kind of goes between them. Sometimes you're just doing your greatest hits, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe you're trying to do something that hasn't been in print in a while and someone hasn't yeah. seen, like, and this will yeah. be their opportunity to see it. But then when you were talking about maybe writing new material for it, that yeah. reminded me of greatest hits albums from like the late 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. There was like this thing where whenever these artists would come out with a greatest hits album, the studio wanted them to write a new song and put it on there. And I remember, I think it was Tom Petty. It may have been Tom Petty. Now, I'm going to attribute this quote to him, but he said, that's really ballsy.
Yeah.
Like putting a new song on a greatest hits album. But the idea was give people something new.
right.
that they could only get if they buy the greatest hits album. Right. And so right. that it just kind of reminded me a little of that. Like, absolutely. Like, you know, you're putting a new story in to try to draw people in to read the other stuff.
It's so funny talking about a greatest hits thing, too, because I mean, there was a real, you know, logistical reason to have such an album. Right. Which is that logistical reason has been so surpassed for so long. Just the idea that, like, I need one CD that has all of my favorite things on it so that I don't need to have six different CDs with my favorite songs. You know what I mean? And yet, and you know, that's the logic of a CD mix or whatever. But the fact that everything is streaming now and has been for so long means that the logic of that kind of collection doesn't really apply in the same way anymore. But it does for books, I think. I mean, just in the sense that, you know, at least in SF, because we have, you know, this ecosystem of magazines and anthologies, long may it last. There is a sense that, you know, you can't just, it's like, it's a real project to try and hunt down every story of an author that you like, that you're going to end up with quite a lot of, a shelf full of different themed anthologies, magazine issues, some of them will not be in print. What are you going to do with that? You know, all of that sort of stuff. But I totally hear you on the ballsiness of being like, my new song will
always going to be a hit too. Just you watch.
Just you wait. Exactly.
That's where Last Dance with Mary Jane came from.
From
Tom Petty. Was on his.
Well, I guess he was right. Yeah. So. Ballsy and correct. So,
indeed.
So there's like 15 other things I could think of to talk about as a result of this conversation, not least of which I think is a wonderful excuse to bring you on again in the future, is how your role as the New York Times science fiction and fantasy columnist interacts with your own, you know, life as a writer in that space. But we'll have to preserve that for Hamala Mothar part two, because it's time for Picks of the Week.
Picks of the Week.
We'll get to Picks of the Week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes, like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month, and that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month, and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever, our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout, and those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host, and the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us, and we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, go forth and bring us joy.
She grew up in the Indiana town, had a good, good mama who never was around. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Before we started recording, I teased that I was going to pick a Canadian treasure, and there are lots of Canadian treasures we can talk about. But the day that this episode drops, which should be May 12th, Netflix is dropping a documentary called Marty, Life is Short. And this is about Martin Short.
Oh.
And he is he's always been one of my favorite comedians. I loved SCTV back in the day when it was mm-hmm. when I was a much younger person, and it was on Friday nights and Saturday nights sometimes. But that is coming on May 12th, and it looks amazing, and it's all about his life. And, you know, he and Steve Martin are real close, and Steve Martin's in it, and a bunch of other people are in it talking about him. And yeah, it's just I've always liked Martin Short. I've always thought he was a great comedian and a great actor. And kind of along the vein of I also liked I Like Me, which was the Ryan Reynolds produced John Candy documentary. I'm looking forward to this one because Martin Short is a Canadian treasure. Aww. So that'll be on Netflix.
Cool.
Fantastic. So, Amal, before we started recording, you were just vigorously note-taking. Like, you were very ready to bring the picks. So,
I was. Yeah. Yeah. The problem that I have is that I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm a really enthusiastic and gregarious person who likes talking.
I haven't about noticed, stuff. But okay.
I keep it really close to the chest.
It's been difficult to get you to speak. As part of this podcast. So.
Opening up is hard for me.
So hard.
Well, it was just that I came prepared. I was going to have just the one thing. First of all, I thought it had to be something that was literally in the last week. And so I was going to say that a feature of my day-to-day that I rarely miss is a browser game called Clues by Sam that I love. It's a little logic puzzle. It's about determining in a grid which persons of which professions are innocent or criminal. And it's just that, like, every time you flip someone, they give you a clue, and we'll say, you know, so-and-so is a criminal, or so-and-so has two criminal neighbors, or whatever. Like, there's, and they start out easy-ish on Monday, and then they ramp up in difficulty over the course of the week. And I love it. And I have been, I was introduced to it, in July of last year. And I found it almost impossibly difficult at first. And then I just kept doing it and saw my time completion go down and stuff. And now my partner and I have a little ritual of just starting our days by doing it together, in as much as we started at the same time. And it's not really like we're not racing each other, but we are kind of just doing it at the same time. Sometimes one of us will, make a mistake and go, no, or... Because the goal is to, for me anyway, is to make no mistakes, ask for no hints from the game, and finish it as quickly as possible. But anyway, it's a delightful little puzzle game. That said, as soon as we started this call and Patrick said that he was going to do a Canadian treasure, I thought that Patrick was speaking of our most important cultural export of the last several decades, which is Heated Rivalry, which is a TV show that is based on the hockey romance novels of mm-hmm. Rachel Reed. And yep. it has brought me almost incalculable joy and pleasure at a deeply needed time. Not only the show itself, but the fan activity around the show has been, how can I put this? There is an account on Instagram called Gilbin Peebles that recreates scenes from Heated Rivalry with little, not plasticine, like just like little figurines that they make up into like a shadow box diorama and like kind of vaguely animate. And it just is,
it's like the robot chicken version of, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, they're so beautiful and lovely, and it just keeps on giving, and every facet of the show or fan engagement that I see about it makes me so happy. And it's basically just a perfect show, and I cannot enough recommend it. other than that, I don't know. Are we going in a round robin, or can I just go down on this? I'll stop if you want me to stop. But
you can do one more. Because we're going to run out of time.
Okay. You know what? I'm looking at my list and I'm trying to pare it down now. I'm like, all right, there's more TV. There's the activity of going for a walk and looking at birds. Because I saw turtles last week and I was very excited. I think I'll actually just say last night started reading an arc I have of Sarah Reese Brennan's next book, which is called All Hail Chaos. So I'll take this as an opportunity to both say her book Long Live Evil was brilliant and I adored it. And it made me feral and insane with the fact that I stayed up until 3 a.m. Trying to finish it because I expected that it was going to give me catharsis because I thought it was a standalone. But I had been misled by an absence from the UK publisher's edition saying that it's one of a series. And so I just felt my soul careen off a cliff at the end. And I was like, what can I do now? So All Hail Chaos is the sequel, which I have begun. It comes out May 26th, I think. And I have started reading it and talking to you has interrupted my reading of it, essentially. So this is how much I value you. And
wow.
Okay. As soon as this conversation is done, I'm going back to the couch.
No, we can't afford for your soul to continue careening off cliffs.
Correct. The thing is, this is only book two of three. So I fully, but now I know. Now I know to at least, it somewhat as I'm going into it. But it's just phenomenal. I just love everything Sarah Reese Brennan writes. I think she's fabulously witty and just very, very insightful and fantastic. And I really like her stuff.
Fantastic. All right. So I'll make this one quick, but one of the many things that I'm reading right now, because I tend to kind of bounce between different things, is a book by Stuart Jeffries, who is a British author, and it's called A Short History of Stupidity. Ooh. It is a nonfiction book, as you might guess from its title, that is literally about sort of looking into, through historical information, psychological information, pop cultural information, sociological, all of those kinds of buckets. What does being stupid mean? Like, what has it meant at different times?
Means you're going to be promoted.
And so it is definitely a book with a sense of humor about its topic. But one of the things that I like best about it is it would be so easy for this book to just be mean. for it to kind of pick targets and to point to certain things as being like, this is a stupid person or this is a stupid idea or just kind of, and to be fair, it does this in certain places, in that I feel probably deserve to have shots fired. But it's much more interested in kind of the question of why are we as humans so concerned with categorizing ideas, people, things, actions, groups, whatever, as stupid? And is there any way for us to actually kind of like measure that and understand that and turn that into a productive exercise? And it's been a really interesting read. So if that sounds like something that you might be tickled by both intellectually and in terms of your sense of humor, if you're a fan of something along like the Bill Bryson or Mary Roach end of things of sort of like science writing, then you would probably really like Stuart Jeffrey's A Short History of Stupidity.
That's great.
All right. So, wow, we've been on a journey here. And like I said, we could no doubt continue it in the future, but for now, it must end. Amala Motar, it has been wonderful talking to you. Where can people go to find you and support all the super cool stuff you do?
Probably the best thing is to go to my website, which is amalanmohtar.com. You can sign up for my newsletter there, which is my preferred way of, you know, actually being in touch with people nowadays, since platforms keep, I don't know, going
sucking
bad and stuff. So that's the best way. Otherwise, you can also follow me on Instagram at Amal Al Mohtar. And I'm also on Blue Sky at amalalmohtar.com. I'm also going to, this is going to air right before I go to Halifax for TriCon, which is a new convention that Trident Books in Halifax is launching, and I'm guest of honor there. So if you are in or around Halifax, I'm going to be there from May 15th to 17th. And other than that, you know, supporting my work by going to your favorite local indie is absolutely an activity I heartily recommend, just because increasingly I am so honestly dazzled by the work that small independent bookstores do within their communities, within this rising tide of awful censorship and fascism, everything that bookstores seem to be doing to both educate and empower their local communities is something that is really invaluable. Increasingly, with the internet becoming more and more saturated with bad things, and things that disconnect us from each other, anything that actually is anchored in physical space, allowing people to encounter, meet, organize and connect with each other is really crucial to me. And I think independent bookstores are an enormously, enormously important part of that. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook, at functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know I couldn't keep a cup aesthetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching. If you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent. So you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know. It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.